Hello, this voice you're hearing is Terry Gilliam.
And this is Chuck Roven.
And we're sitting in a beautiful penthouse suite with lots of, you know, beautiful men and women around us, you know, lots of drinks. And we're here to talk to you about this little film we've made.
So one of the things we should probably jump right into is the legend, what I call the legend or the title card that starts with the quote. You and I had a very long and probably for you tiring debate about this.
The one thing you'll discover about Chuck in the course of this Laserdisc is he's the most tenuous man out there. He doesn't let go of the bone no matter what. We put this opening card on at the very last moment because when we had screened the film, people seemed to accept the reality of the future because it was so detailed and so such a lot of time was spent on there. And to me, one of the important things about the film was to maintain an ambiguity about whether it was in Cole's mind or not. So by putting that statement at the front, it immediately says, this is what you're about to see is possibly the workings of a madman's mind.
The reason that I felt so strongly that something needed to be on there was because in the early screenings, we had quite a few comments from various audience members that they found it very difficult to get into the time and place of the first sequences, what are actually taking place in the underground world of the future. And I had been hopeful that by putting a legend on there, that people would be more comfortable with where they were, and they would be able to not be fighting to understand what was going on. But Terry rightly felt that if we made it too easy for them, the ambiguity would be lost. And after 30 weeks of discussion on this, one day Terry came in and made both of us very happy.
I should comment on the opening, on that mandala that of the monkeys going around. It's very hypnotic, and it struck me that it's very much what the film is about. It's a circular thing. It's a wheel that keeps going round and round and round, and our characters never get off it, basically. They die, they're reborn, they die, and they're reborn. And
well, I think also what you did with the titles underneath never really coming into focus, and as soon as they come into focus, they start to get blurry and go away, was also trying to get everybody into just even subconsciously or subliminally the idea that what you think you're seeing may not be exactly so. What you think you're hearing may not be exactly so.
It's funny that opening music, which is based on Astor Piazzolla's work, is the result of early discussions with, in fact, Ray Cooper, who has been music producer on my previous films, and he suggested I go and listen to some Argentinian tangos, and I went out to find tangos by Gardel and couldn't down in Philadelphia Blockbuster Video, which this will be available on. I think this you can get this Laserdisc there right now. Anyway, and I couldn't find any on Gardel, but I found this other guy called Piazzolla, and I started playing this music, and I thought, this is fantastic. And for the entire course of making the film and through most of the post-production, I kept listening to this piece of music and couldn't work out what to do with it. I knew it was important because it seemed to be mad and passionate and dangerous. And it reminded me of French Nouvelle Vague films. There was something existential about it, even. And I kept putting it on different scenes, driving scenes, romantic scenes, and it didn't work. And then one day I woke up and said, it's the
main theme.
It's the theme for the movie. Where are we now? Oh,
we're with Bruce getting ready to go out. And
this plastic suit was important. I mean, a lot of what is going on in this film seemed to be about a future or even a present that was about people frightened of viruses, frightened of infection, frightened of in a sense of being infected by each other, and how you defend yourself against others and viruses and environments. So condoms became an idea that wouldn't go away, and I liked the idea of making a suit that was like a full-size human condom. It relates to viruses, which and AIDS and everything. There's a lot of resonance in that.
This suit was one of the really a great example of really great collaboration with a lot of the different departments. Julie Weiss, the costume designer, and Terry first came up with the idea of the condom idea, and
Doug Harlacher.
Doug Harlacher, the prop man, decided that, you know, he got into it by making sure that there were all these bits and parts that actually worked. The whole thing was really mechanized. The oxygen that's going on there is real. And then, of course, Jeff Beecroft, the production designer, he had his hand also in helping to create the.
It's an interesting thing of trying to make all of the departments work together, because in films there's a tendency for it to become departmentalized. Everybody's got their little empire, and they close out the others and do their little bit. And my approach to filmmaking is to try to make sure all the doors are open, that people are constantly relating to one another, because you stumble on ideas just by rubbing shoulders day in and day out.
Yeah, I have to tell you, one of the most interesting things that I found was, because, you know, I'd never worked with Terry before, and many people had told me that, you know, he was a really firm believer in the auteur theory of filmmaking, and it was exactly the opposite. Everybody was completely invited to collaborate, and of course, really what was happening was Terry was co-opting some great ideas.
Yeah, basically, I become the filter, and I say yes and no, and the good ideas go through, and the bad ones I stop, and in the end, I take credit for all of them. but the reality is, it's a very much a group effort. We ought to talk about this future here, because this all took place in downtown Philadelphia. It's all around the city hall, the square, in the very center of the town.
And in fact, we were not able to shut the city down, although they did a tremendous job of holding traffic for us and everything and rerouting some traffic. But we actually shot that, I think, over a weekend. But the city was still operating.
We had actually put the camera very low in the corner of this square, right on the ground, and we laid snow out. And at the end of this, and it's probably only about 50 feet from camera to the end of our snowed area, we had a little lip that went up about 18 inches, and that was enough at that angle to block out the road and the traffic. Traffic could have actually been driving during that shot, except for the odd bus, but we stopped traffic nevertheless. And then we
there you know, you're seeing right there in that shot there, it's a mixture of real birds, and then those birds turn into animated birds, which is all I found very interesting.
Yeah, all of this is, these are real buildings that we then aged in the computer, using computer-generated snow. We had put some snow down on the ground, with some icing, some icicle that was real, and then we added to it. The actual snow flurries themselves are all done, again, by computer. There is apparently a husband-wife team that live in Texas that give you snow flurries, and however you want them, dense, high wind, big flakes, little flakes. The top of this here is we built the foreground on top of the roof of City Hall, and the rest of the buildings were aged later.
Also by computer.
Yeah. This, of course, was done in the parking lot, the shot of the foot revealing. Yeah, I mean,
this was actually the last shot that we did, very last shot on the very last day.
All of this is sitting, you know, literally these scenes are on top of the City Hall. It's a wonderful building. It's a great Beaux-Arts building, we had access to, thanks to the Philadelphia mayor and film department.
One of the things that we didn't have was a tremendous large budget. So rather than being able to build the sets, what normally would want to do within the great controlled atmosphere of a stage, we had to find a place that had kind of the bare bones of sets we might use, and that's one of the reasons that we went to Philadelphia and Baltimore, where we found these huge power stations, and all these underground world sets were built there in these great edifices of the great the machine age?
the industrial age of technology, the dream of progress, because this film is very much about decay and about man's, stupidity in a sense, the man, you know, destroying what he's made. And there's something about Philadelphia. There was the, you know, first capital of the country, formerly an incredibly rich city, very industrialized city. And then after the Second World War, industry moved out, went west. And this place is kind of a strange kind of wasteland. It's almost a third world city with a very rich center. And after that, it just disintegrates. So we had access to these two power stations that there's no use for them anymore because there's no demand for that electricity.
But it's too expensive to tear them down.
Yeah.
I think the cost of tearing one of these power stations down was estimated to be about $25 million, so they were there.
What's interesting is, what I like is going into places that exist because we find things in there that you wouldn't invent normally, and then you adapt them for the film. Because if you sit down and design a set from scratch, I find it always very limited in its scope, and it's lacking in surprises and quirkiness, things that it's too controlled. And so by going into real places, you're forced to think and rethink your ideas, and you adapt them to these places. The video ball and the chair were important elements in this film, because I loved the idea of an interrogation taking place where the interrogee is higher than the interrogators, which is not the normal way of doing it. But there's a sense of vertigo when you're hanging up there. You're totally vulnerable. It's like a butterfly stuck on a wall, pinned down by scientists, you know, observing and dissecting this thing. That was the feeling I wanted. And yet, then I wanted to, again, separate people from people. So even though they could be having a direct conversation, there's this technology, all this video works in the video ball intervening between them. So for Cole, he's never quite able to see the scientists directly because there's this technology stuck in his face.
What I really loved about the video ball was the sense that the video ball was sort of sniffing him out, even though it was a visual, there were all these visual images on front of the ball.
It's kind of like a big eye right there, right in your face, so it makes him very small looking and very vulnerable.
But I remember when we were when the ball was being constructed and we were getting it ready to use it, I went out there one day with Lloyd Phillips, who was the line producer, and we were trying to get it to work right, to be smooth in terms of it, and it was very frustrating because I thought it really looked terrible. But when it came to the day, those little kind of jerky movements of it actually looked really great.
Gave it personality.
It gave it personality, exactly, like it was alive.
Yeah. I wanted to make that room kind of strange. It was like a puzzle room. The entire film is in that room if you can look at all the details and then put them in the right order. This scene in the police station was actually, again, in the power station. We were way up. This is the first day's shooting, actually. And we were up at the very top of the power station, so it was impossible to get things up there, and it was freezing cold. Everything was as difficult as you could make it. This is one of those moments when you realize, oh, we're making some big mistakes. But it didn't, in fact, affect anything. We got through it as planned.
I mean, actually, it was really a wonderful day shooting because we jumped right into it, and, you know, we were curious to make sure to see whether or not, you know, Bruce could get past the diehard image and, you know, show himself to be vulnerable. And I remember at the end of the day, you were very, very pleased because it was very clear that we were going to see a different kind of acting from Bruce than...
Yeah, he was fantastic. I mean, and he has no... In a strange way, he has no ego when he gets involved in this. He was quite happy to do anything to make him, you know, the drooling, the slobbering, the drug haze that he's in. He has no fear of that, and that's exciting. Again, cages. Cages are constant throughout the film. I mean, it begins in a cage. We're in cages here. It was always that sense of people. And I wanted, especially the cages in the future, I wanted them to look like the cages you would see in a lab, where you would keep animals for experiments, so that these things constantly are referring to other aspects of the film. Nothing sort of stands on its own. Everything has a reference to something else. Getting Bruce, it was a weird thing trying to decide what he's going to be wearing in this cage, because if he arrives and he arrives naked, what is he going to do? And he went around, either he mugged an old lady or he found something in a trash can, and it was a woman's, you know, plastic raincoat. So he looks like, you know, the cops are going to arrest this guy, some weird pervert wandering the streets, and nothing he says is going to make sense to them.
Yet it made sense that it would be something that he might reach for, the plastic, because it would remind him of his spacesuit.
Yeah, exactly. Again, that's the other version of the spacesuit. And it's, again, seeing Bruce, you know, this rather tough character from the future, and now we see him like this caged animal, this pathetic creature who is totally... vulnerable, lost. It was important to achieve that. From the beginning, when we first started talking to Bruce about this project, it was trying to trying to get him to have a sense of total lostness. Is this the word? it is now, folks. And it's a
confusion.
Confusion, lost, vulnerable. And he's not really shown that in previous films. And to me, that was, I suppose, from my point of view, one of the biggest jobs for me is to make him feel comfortable enough to achieve that.
Madeline, on the other hand, was, I think that you and I, from the very first time that we talked about, you know, who would play Dr. Rayleigh, we agreed that we needed somebody that could bring to the part, you know, a certain kind of vulnerability and ethereal quality, but also be somebody who we would believe would be very intelligent and articulate, and I think almost in one voice we talked about Madeline.
Well, she was, I remember when the name, we were reading a list of potential actresses, and when her name came up, I think we all went, yes, that's it. And that was kind of the end of the conversation. I keep going on in the reviews about the number of times you see Bruce naked. I don't know what this is telling us about the reviewers. They seem to be very excited about it. In fact, they said it would sell very well in video. So obviously there's a big gay market out there that we should be tapping. It's very strange how reviewers obsess about things like that. Because, you know, Bruce has been naked in enough films. People are always naked. Why is it even something one discusses? Because the point was, we keep seeing him being showered. He's completely stripped of anything. He has nothing other than just his skin and bones. And
obviously when somebody's naked and he's in a completely vulnerable situation, and that's...
The
where we shot this was, and I know you keep correcting me. I always keep saying that it was the first prison in the United States, but it's actually the first penitentiary built in the United States.
And penitentiary is a very specific word. It's about penitence. They weren't there to be punished as such. They were there to discover their God, and it was all solitary confinement. And it's a very it's built like a great wheel with spokes, and all of these corridors go from the central core. And people, apparently the suicide rate there was incredibly high because this idea of just being stuck in solitary with you, your soul, and your God drove people crazy. So it seemed the perfect place for a mental hospital.
I think actually this building was built, what, in the late 1700s? It was a 1790 or something like that. And it was, I think, used up until the 1920s or 1930s.
Al Capone was held there briefly, yeah. What was interesting, because mental hospitals don't look like this. And we had to make a choice of whether we were going to go and be realistic, or we would be show the world, in effect, through Cole's eyes. Now, this room, it really intrigued me because it has these three corridors heading off. So it's this triangular room with three tunnels to escape or to whatever. And it seemed perfect for a schizophrenic brain. It was very representative of that, and it's which path do you take? Which is the way out? Where do you go? And it's a confused place. And one, I mean, I'm not really interested in doing, you know, naturalistic, realistic filmmaking in that sense. I like making expressionistic films or hyper-realistic films where you take things and the architecture all is the architecture is another character basically. It's not just a building. It's a place that has ideas, characters, it has an effect on the people within it. This is the first day shooting on Brad. He arrived after months of preparation, and he exploded this day.
It was
extraordinary.
It was wonderful. I remember when we first got together with him, he had initially was interested in playing the Cole part, and we told his representatives that we felt that he was too young for that role, that we needed as much distance as we could from the age of the character as we see him now to when he was a little boy, so that there would be a better sense of not a clear memory of the dreams. And then remember that you and he met in London, I think, for the first time, and you started talking to him about the role of Jeffrey Goines.
And he was kind of ready for it, because what actors always do in these meetings is they prepared and they show you the character that they're trying to sell you on. And suddenly Brad, who has always been, you know, notoriously laconic and quiet and all, suddenly was a very bright, bouncy, zippy character. And He can do it. He's got the stuff. And what was interesting was that he was so determined to prove he could do it. And in a sense, that's what was true with Bruce as well. These were people trying to show to the world that they had a greater range than the, you know, the system encourages. And that's, to me, is what was interesting. It's constantly, you know, changing people's perceptions, and not only of the world, but of what you think of Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt, actors. And in many ways, it almost would have been safer casting to cast them the opposite, with Brad as the dreamy, lost character, and Bruce as the smart, fast-talking, but it would be boring. It would be predictable.
Well, Brad really went into, from the time that he knew he had the role, which I think was in October, he actually didn't start shooting until April, because he had this film Seven that he was doing in between. But from October, he went into a very rigorous schedule of trying to build up his what do you call it, the syncopation of his talk.
Basically, we had a voice coach with him, and he, you know, had to literally work like an athlete, training his tongue and his lips
to
sprint rather than be a marathon runner.
And then he also did a tremendous amount of research into a manic depressive schizophrenia.
Yeah.
And when he came to Philadelphia, went to and met with encounter groups of manic depressives, schizophrenics, and actually checked himself into the mental ward of a hospital. And
as Jeffrey,
he did such a good job. For a moment, they weren't going to let him out.
I think what was interesting in all of this, especially the scene with Bruce and Brad, there's Brad has this incredible energy leaping around, and Bruce is such a I've never seen him so still and fascinating. And I find when I watch it, I'm watching both of them, and normally, you know, Brad would dominate because he's doing everything, and your eyes would go to him. But what Bruce is doing is so quiet and still and intense that your attention is pulled both directions, which is, you know, what one had hoped. I was really impressed with Bruce in that scene, because it's so internalized. And in the past, he's always been such an external actor. He's used, you know, he's run around, he's blown up the world. And this was a chance for him to take it all inside and find a way of expressing it without, you know.
Well, I think you had met Bruce earlier. Didn't you guys almost collaborate once before? I think it was on the Fisher King.
On Fisher King we met, and I really liked him. We spent an afternoon together, and I thought, oh, there's a lot more going on here than I expected. In fact, we talked about this scene in the first Die Hard that intrigued me, and it's a scene where he's got his feet full of glass, and he's in the toilet of this building, and he's on the phone to his wife, and he's crying when he's talking to her, and he said that was his idea to cry, it wasn't in the script. And I thought, ah, there's more going on here than the world thinks. And from that moment on, I was intrigued by him. And so when the idea of him playing his part came up, Chuck and I went to New York, and we spent an evening with him, and we all seemed to be talking the same language. That's very important, because I think we were lucky to catch both Bruce and Brad at a moment when they wanted to show something different.
Well, Brad, I remember when, because we had talked vaguely about what Brad's look was going to be like, we actually didn't get into it until he came to Philadelphia. And I think the week before, he had been chosen by People magazine as one of the sexiest men alive or whatever, and he was completely committed to making sure that image was...
I mean, the idea of the... dark eyes and the askew eye was his idea. His hair chopped like that, he chopped it himself. So he was determined to escape from this trap. So we were the beneficiaries. One of the things that really intrigued me was having Frank Gorshin as the head of the psychiatric institution. And we, in the casting meetings, Margie Simkin, the casting director, said, you know, Frank Gorshin, she brought up his name as a possible desk clerk for later on in the film. And I was just curious, because none of us had seen Frank Gorshin in a long time, so we got him in, and he was quite wonderful, and he said, but surely there's some bigger parts available.
Well, I think didn't you originally read him for one of the scientists?
No, he was going to be the desk clerk at the end in the Seedy Hotel.
Oh, right.
And he wanted something bigger, and he said, well, you know, what about Dr. Goines? And I said, well, that's been taken. We got Chris Plummer. And he said, then he suggested the other, and we read. And he was fantastic. Because, again, here's somebody who was trained as a classic actor, a really fine actor, who unfortunately had this talent for impersonation. And he was so successful as being an impersonator that his whole dramatic acting career took a back seat. But here was a nice chance to use him as a serious actor. And the idea of the Riddler being the head of a psychiatric institute pleased me as well. Now the dreams. The dreams, we as you see, I mean, we burnt them out. We wanted them to have this quality of not sure what they were and where they were. And shot them all in slow motion, again, dreamlike quality. Our problem was that in the script, it was very easy to describe these characters running around. One, you know, the character of Cole had a flapping mustache, wig, but every time we tried to shoot these things for real, you could see it was Bruce's nose. His nose is a very identifiable nose, so we had to change what we did in a sense. It was very important that we disguise, you know, Rayleigh and Cole, that the audience didn't know who they were.
Initially, they could find out more and more as each dream happens. More and more, the idea was to reveal more and more, but initially, they needed to be completely camouflaged.
Yeah.
And the camouflaging had to happen not just as a result of the way that they were made up, but also, I think, the angles that you chose to shoot.
Yeah. It was actually very hard, particularly Bruce, because he's got a very unique nose. It starts off as a very exciting nose, going to be a great Roman nose, and then it goes clunk, falls off at the end, and you can't disguise it. Again, we're the mental hospital. This is actually the very center of the penitentiary, and working with this spider was quite nice. I mean, Bruce was, again, a lot of people would panic about a spider, but he really got into it.
And eating the spider.
The spider, at the last minute, we had to make all these
and chocolate things. Spiders.
Yeah. But again, I find Brad's manic behavior, all of his
hands
are just extraordinary. And it's again, what intrigues me about these two very different styles of acting. Now, what's interesting when you talk to people about the film, there are those, it kind of splits the viewers, those who prefer Bruce's style to Brad's style, and then the others who prefer Brad to Bruce. It's intriguing how something Brad is over the top, and other things he's spot on. Some people think Bruce is underplaying, other things he's spot on. And it's two styles that I stretch. I mean, to me, I don't have a problem. I like that huge breadth of acting styles. But a lot of people, when they watch films, want things to be neatly packaged. You don't want to be funny and serious at the same time, and I try to do both.
I'll tell you what was really an extraordinary thing for me was, you know, Bruce allowing himself to be so still while all of this whirlwind of Brad is around him.
Yeah.
The control of that, I thought, was really, really tremendous.
But that's like, you know, that's a smart actor at work. You know, you make a choice. Either you try to compete on the same level or you take the opposite. And he did, and it was right. And at the same time, what was nice on these days working with the two of them together is how supportive Bruce was to Brad. Because Brad was like the new kid in town, and then, you know, Bruce was the old gunfighter. And rather than competing, he was incredibly supportive. I mean, in those days, he was wonderful.
When we were shooting this the sequence, wasn't it right near April Fool's Day? And didn't you and Brad
concoct
some kind of a fight?
Yeah, no, that was actually later. It was later, but we did. Brad came up and said, "April Fool's Day today, let's do something and let's start a fight." And we did, and I started pushing him and saying, "You know, spoiled actor, you're late." And I think he was a bit surprised by how thorough I was in my anger, and I looked at his eyes and I saw shock, but we had to keep moving. We actually had we almost came to blows, but what was fascinating was to watch the crew disappear, how
everybody
nobody wanted to get involved, except for Vinny, who was the focus puller. He was the oldest member of the crew, and he was the one that came in, and of course, as he grabbed us, we all turned around and said, "April Fools." But it's very interesting how a crew operates when you see a battle between the star and the director, how invisible they become.
Yeah, nobody wants to intervene in that one. Everybody thinks it's the fastest way to go home.
Yeah. Now, Brad's mooning was his idea again. I mean, I take credit for nothing in this film. I just let it happen. And
there again, I think we got criticized by by some for saying that there's another reason.
Yeah.
Another one. Another.
They think we're being opportunistic, but we're not. I mean, it just seemed funny at the time. Is it right? I love it when actors come up with ideas. That's the great thing. It's not about directing them and guiding them and giving them all the ideas. What you do is you try to make it a comfortable experience so that they feel confident in taking chances and supplying new thoughts. And what about this? And what about that? And if you make them comfortable, you get all this for free, basically. All of this stuff with the rabbits and the animals is real footage, folks. That's what really goes on in the name of nicer eyeshadow, better lipstick, those things. And it's very interesting how the audience reacts to that. When they see that, they really gasp. They hate it. But that's probably the only real thing in the film.
I think everything on TV, almost everything on, well, I think the newscasting we created.
Yeah, we created all that.
But almost everything else was from various bits and pieces of real news footage that we...
We ended up making, you know, television basically a repository for cartoons. We reduced it to something as simple as that, which is kind of my view, a personal view. What was very nice, too, is that we used a lot of local actors, again, because we were making a film, even though we had big stars in it, it was very much like making a low-budget movie, and we had to get local talent. We couldn't afford to fly people in from L.A. and New York. And that was one of the most satisfying parts, to discover all these people in Philadelphia, good actors, good people who hadn't had a chance to, you know, do their work.
It was really surprising. Many of them worked in local theater and did, you know, local shows, and they were really... really excellent to work with, and you know, very committed.
These were the most method actors of all in this scene. All the people playing the madmen, because once they were in character, they kind of stayed in character all day long. What do we got here? Marx Brothers, Keys. I mean, it's just wonderful things in the script from David and Jan. I mean, the whole idea of this word key, which became monkeys in Key West and the Keys, Florida Keys. It becomes quite hypnotic.
You know, the interesting thing about what the work that Dave and Jan did when they, you know, took the original idea or the inspiration of 12 Monkeys from Chris Marker's early 60s 27-minute photo novel, Le Jeté. I call it a photo novel because it's a series of stills. Many people call it a 27-minute short film, but I think there's only one bit of movement
yeah.
in the whole film. But really, you know, we definitely took the idea of a character going from the future to the past, or Dave and Jan took the idea of a character going from the future to the past, and embraced the image of this dream that this character has of a young boy, and that boy, of course, turns out to be him witnessing his own death. But the whole idea of madness and sanity and how close the two are related, and what is real and what is not real, and what is sane and what is insane, that was a complete invention of Dave and Jan.
Mm. No, I mean, I think the original film is a very simple, beautiful film, and it's one that I personally avoided watching until we had finished this film, because I didn't want to be accused of stealing from it, because we knew that's what the reviewers would do. And they did it anyway.
Well,
the point was not to be affected by it, to try to do the script. Because when I read the script, that's what intrigued me, not La Jeté. The script intrigued me because I thought it was such the poetry of somebody seeing their own death and not understanding what that meant and yet being affected by it all of their life was extraordinary. And the other thing was that I loved what they had done with Jeffrey Goins, Brad's character, because he became a very funny voice about the madness of the society we live in. And it was a way of criticizing the society, showing the madness, and yet doing it in a funny, entertaining way. And the script reading, I remember the first time reading it, it was one of those things, every time you turned the page, you didn't know what was going to happen next. And that's exciting, because normally you read scripts, and within the first few pages, you kind of know where this one's going to go. You know the style. And yeah, I couldn't predict what was going to happen in this one.
Well, I remember the first time that I talked to you, you gave two really wonderful compliments. The first one was, you said that you were completely annoyed that you hadn't written it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the second was that you couldn't believe that script had been developed in the Hollywood system, and you were wondering how it snuck through.
Well, that was it, and that was part of the reason for joining the team at that point. Well, let's continue this sneaky guerrilla activity within the system. The idea of getting a film like this, which by any standards I would say would be a European art film, it's full of ideas. It makes the public think. You know, you've got to really involve yourself in this thing. The film doesn't do the work for you. You've got to participate. Now that demands a lot more than is normally demanded of an audience. And I thought to get this through the whole system, it'd be fun to be part of the process.
One of the best feelings that I had, I don't know how you felt about it, was after Chris Marker saw the film, our film, 12 Monkeys, he sent a telegram to Dave and Jan, I think to you, where he thanked all of us for allowing him to be a small part of the making of this movie, which I have to say, even though I think it was maybe a little bit too humble, because his movie is absolutely considered to be
a classic
of all time. But it was really gratifying, incredibly gratifying to have him, really enjoy this film and embrace it.
Because I think it's so different from the original that they shouldn't really be compared. The original inspired it. And that was interesting. We had a major fight to get that credit on the screen, inspired by, because until this film, that credit hasn't existed.
The Writers Guild doesn't have that credit. They only have from and based on.
It, which is extraordinary. The Writers Guild, the protectors of the words, the ones that are supposed to have all the words, have such a limited vocabulary. Well, we've helped expand their vocabulary. But it's funny how hard that, Chuck spent a lot of time getting that. Dave and Jan had to write letters. You get into a lot of very silly things. I remember with the Directors Guild, they wanted my credit to be bigger because contractually it's supposed to be, but I said it's wrong. And we had to then get dispensation for them so that I could have a smaller credit, which was right for what we were doing in the title sequence.
Right, and ultimately they said, well, we're here to protect the director's creative rights, and so therefore we then went back and said, well, if we're trying to protect the director's creative rights creatively, he wants his name to be smaller, so let him have it.
But it's very interesting how these institutions have become, supposed to be there for one reason, have ended up being the institutions we're fighting, the ones that are supposed to protect us. But it's always been like that. I think this was shot in a college in Philadelphia, which was a college built by a philanthropist in, I think, the late 18th century, again, for orphaned boys.
One of the things that always is a big signature of your work, Terry, is your use of extremely wide-angle lenses, even for close-ups. You seem to pack a tremendous amount into each visual frame.
It's a greediness on my part. When I'm looking through the camera, it's like I'm not really in the film, and so I've got to put a wider lens on and push it in closer, and eventually it becomes, they include so much more information. It's actually much harder to work with wide-angle lenses because it's harder to hide the lights. Composition becomes more complicated. With a long lens, it's very easy because a long lens pulls everything out of focus except the thing you're wanting to look at. So it's very easy to compose and shoot that way. And it tells the story very clearly. You don't have extraneous detail distracting your eye. But I like the fact of having a lot of extraneous detail that may or may not be extraneous, because you have to work the whole time. Your eye has to work. It's kind of like the real world, trying to find out what are the things that really are important in my life and which things aren't important, because this information is coming at you. In a sense, especially with Cole, I can justify it, because here's a character who comes from a very limited world and is now thrown into our world, and he doesn't know what are the important things and what are the unimportant things. He's inundated with information, as indeed we are. We're inundated with television, radio, movies, newspapers. Noise is at us the whole time. White noise surrounds our life, and it's very hard, I think, it certainly is for me, sometimes to distinguish what is important and what isn't. What is the world, what isn't the world? And so, in a sense, Cole, to me, becomes every man in this movie, going through what most of us go through in life.
But the decision to constantly go with the wide-angle lenses is something that you've used not just in this film. You do.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's a true signature of your work. And you've worked most of the time, I think, and on the movies that you've directed with Roger Pratt, right? Well, didn't he start as the...
Yeah, he was the clapper loader on Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and we became friends then. And for years, I kept trying to get him to make the leap to become a director of photography, and he always held back because he's one of those people that had to earn it, who had to learn the craft before he took the mantle on. And I've always, you know, respected him for that and love him for that because, and Brazil was the first film we worked together on. And it's a very easy relationship. Most of the time we barely talk to each other. We grunt. It becomes sort of Neanderthal directing and because we know what we're doing and we don't spend a lot of time theorizing over what it is or isn't we should be doing. We get a few pictures, books, a few ideas, and something like that.
So he was the director of photography on Brazil, and he was the director of photography on Fisher King,
yeah.
And so this is the third
time, yeah.
And the English system is extremely different in terms of how cameramen and directors of photography deal with the director versus the American system. I mean, even though most of the time in the American system there's an operator and a director of photography. In the English system, where there's also an operator and a director of photography, it seems that the operator gets almost as creatively involved as a director of photography in the angle and the lens size that is discussed with you. How did that work?
Well, it becomes this trio. I mean, the operator is the one sitting there on the camera that has to actually physically capture the moment. And oftentimes the DPs, especially in America, they just worry about the lights. They set the lights up and let the I'm confused. I'm saying that's the English version, yeah, where the operator is in a sense choosing the shot. It's a very, the operator gets the worst credit on a film for what he contributes to the film. It's a credit that's way down the bottom, and yet Roger and I and the operator, whoever it's been, in this instance it was Craig Hagenson, who also operated on Fisher King, we work as this little trinity, and I don't even know how we work. We just know instinctively what we're doing, and we'll put a lens on, say, put an 18mm lens on, we look at, no, that's not right. And we have this very informal, easy conversation, and it also becomes a game sometimes. It's just fun trying to get a better shot.
Well, that's the one thing that I always found out about you, Terry. It's not okay if it's right and simple. It's got to be right and difficult.
But that's the thing. You're sitting there, and yes, you could do it very straightforward and simply, but what's the point of that? To me, each time you make a film, I want to push the limits a bit and see what we're learning, what we can do, how good we're getting. It's kind of a test. You get these little marks every so often to see how you're doing.
Wasn't this set described as a dark room, and Coles wheeled in on
a gurney and slid into a steel tube, and that was it. And I mean, I felt that somewhere in the middle of the film, we had to really show the future again. We had to give the audience a spectacular moment because we have a big opening sequence, and then we never see it properly again. And we again, this is in one of the big power stations, and what intrigued me was this huge face of this condenser, which is about 18 foot in diameter, and this massive steel thing, and in the middle of it was a hole just about the size of a man. And we built things almost backwards. This is the condenser face we started from. So then the trick was, how do you get the man up there? And we decided, well, let's put him in a rig that flies across there. Then what kind of thing should he be in? Well, it's got to be like the bubbles that they use for people who have been exposed to deadly viruses. And we saw a 24 hours video about the Ebola virus. And these people were put into this weird kind of gurney with a plastic bubble over it, with plastic hands that could reach and deal. So the person is totally isolated. And we started working from that. And again, I like the idea of a chrysalis. It was almost like a birth in the middle of the film, a rebirth in this film. And you had this amniotic sac. It was also like a chrysalis. And he's naked. He's like a larva. So there's lots of, stages of early life, totally vulnerable. And then he's thrust into this great steel birth canal, and ends up in World War I. And to me, it was, again, it's this contrast of textures. It's something soft and light and delicate and something hard and brutal. And you put these things together and you get wonderful juxtapositions. So we have several areas in there. There's the technological area there with the big condenser face, and the other area is the medical area, which is all people are in sterilized conditions. It became, when we put the whole set together and looked at it, it was almost like an opera set, strange enough. And then we've got some strange costumes, like the head scientist.
Well, what I really loved about what one of the scientists were wearing was a suit, and then he had the plastic covering on the outside of the suit, and so that the thing that had originally been created for the culture to protect people had now become fashion. Yeah. I really thought that was really an inspired bit of costume design by Julia.
That was a nice thing. I mean, I've kind of been obsessed by plastic covers ever since I was a kid, and I think my parents, when we bought a new sofa suite, they had the plastic cover on for years afterwards to protect it. And in Time Bandits, I've got that. It's always this thing. The people are so worried about protecting something and keeping it forever that they actually ruin the joy and the pleasure of the thing. It's a particularly American problem, that one. I mean, thrusting him into World War I was always intriguing. There's one thing I should comment on, is the time machine, the interior, when you get that flashing black and white, almost stroboscopic effect. And rather than spending a fortune on a big special effect, when I had my little video camera, my high-8 camera, I was going around the
various locations.
Yeah, the various locations, and we found these backlit stairs and all these weird rods, and this is somewhere in the power stations, and I ran along with my camera, and it gave this great effect. So that was our time machine. We just got the crew in there and shot it, and it cost us about $5, and that was it.
Well, you know, one of the things that you told me early on when we started to work together was that that as you moved along and got more and more involved in the creation of the pictures and the visuals, and so things would have a tendency to grow, and that I always needed to make sure that there was room to let things grow, because
and that's one of the things. I mean, I sort of the standard speech to all the departments early on. You know, we're going to try to hold this thing back in, and keep it small, keep the budget down, keep less at the start, because it will grow. I used to do that. I remember in Brazil, we chose one particular studio because it was very small. There wasn't room to build big sets, so we were hampered. We created parameters that held us in check, and it's kind of like that. I mean, because the whole process is an organic process, and it isn't like it's all perfectly planned out at the start. We develop as we go along, as we start looking for locations, and we find something, you know, that's more interesting, let's change it. The lecture, I originally wanted a certain kind of lecture hall, which you only really find in London, and we couldn't find anything like it in the States. So there was this great building in the middle of Philadelphia. It was built for the Centennial Exposition.
But we also got into the fact that I think as we were picking the locations for the underground world of the future, and they kept growing in terms of their scope and their size, we all of a sudden realized that we were creating such an interesting world of the future that we needed to come back and make sure that we were created a very interesting world of the present.
That's right. There has to be this balance to hold the whole thing together. And once it starts, what intrigued me about this was we come out of World War I, which to me was my chance to do Paths of Glory, Kubrick's Paths of Glory. And then we come into this great hall, which reminded me of those great European buildings, again, in Paths of Glory. So there was these strange connections going on, at least in my head. Of course, we had this problem in Philadelphia because we shot this film in the winter, and we had to make a choice whether the film was going to have snow or not snow in the contemporary sequences.
And just before we started shooting, I think they had this big, huge storm. I think it was in January and about...
It was, in fact, the weekend before we started shooting, because I said, whatever the conditions are that weekend, we will go with them. And it was beautiful. There was snow everywhere, and we made the choice to go with snow, and it never snowed again. So every bit of snow you see in the film has been man-made. That was foam in front of that building. And a lot of the snow is made by grinding up ice, so there were people with, you know, cartons of dry of crumbled ice spread everywhere.
We did amazing things for the ice business in Philadelphia during the winter. You know that, what do they say? You can't sell somebody ice in the winter. They sold us a lot of ice
there
in the winter in Philadelphia.
Exactly.
Now this was one of the this was the start of what turned out to be actually the biggest post-production nightmare of the film.
Exactly.
This scene originally started, normally when you do insides of cars that are traveling, you do them live, you attach the car to what we call a...
I don't know what you call them. Low loader.
A low loader.
You call it a low loader. You put a car on it, and then you drag it around town, and the actor's in it.
Now, because of the different kind of weird angles that Terry likes, and also because he's not accessible to the actors when they're on a low loader, he actually has to be on the car that's towing the vehicle. After one night of not getting all the work done, Terry said, you know what, we should actually do these shots on a stage, blue screen, and then we'll go out and shoot second unit plates of the background, and we'll marry the two together in post-production. I've done it all the time. It's really simple. It will cost us hardly anything. And we can do it very quickly, and we'll save time in the process.
There we go. And unfortunately, there was something that nobody still explained to me properly that went wrong. And, in fact, they couldn't pull decent mats off this material. And a lot of this stuff had to be done by hand. In fact, all this car stuff, what you're seeing now, is in a stage in a little warehouse in Baltimore. We wiggled the car, we put it on inner tubes and things, move it around, and it's a blue screen, and the background was shot from traveling vehicles.
So all that background was actually shot at a separate time, on a separate date, with a separate second unit crew, and ultimately then composited or married with the foreground action, which is the two actors.
And it's very, you know, there's nothing spectacular about it, but it ended up being one of the most expensive aspects of
it. It also actually caused us a big problem in post-production in terms of the previews of the film, because we were not able to get the married shots until really the very last week of post-production, after the film had been locked already for a month or 6 weeks. And so when we were previewing the film to show it to an audience to make a decision about what we wanted to keep and what we wanted to change, we had to preview the film with the blue screen in the background. And, you know, you can tell an audience that what you're going to see is not complete, and you can tell an audience that there's going to be these technical problems in the thing. But every single time that Bruce came on with this blue background, the audience would laugh or chuckle or make some kind of noise that they were completely out of the movie, and you knew that they had to get back in. And it was very difficult to tell how much emotional impact this scene
has. And this is, to me, this is one of the great scenes in the film. This is one of my two favorite scenes. And this is a moment where we see something in Bruce that we've never seen before. This total childlike joy, this ecstasy, totally out there. And it was, and to me, this and the later scene in the hotel were, from my point of view, the most satisfying part of my work, to actually feel that as a director, we got Bruce to this level where you saw something you've never seen before. I love this scene. And what was intriguing is Bruce, this was done, I think, in the penultimate week of the shoot. And I said, when we did this, I said, now we're ready to make the film, Bruce. But it was an extraordinary moment, because he did this scene and he just went ecstatic, and the whole crew, we all knew, wow, it's fantastic. And talking to him immediately after, it was like he had lost control for the first time in his career, where he'd let go and just let the thing take him over. And it was frightening to him and exhilarating at the same time. I was so happy. Now, we could never have achieved that on this low loader, because you're sitting here running around town. You've got, you know, you've got police outriders. You're controlling all the lights. The business of doing those kinds of shots is so complicated. It's very exciting at the time, because you're sitting there on this vehicle and the whole city is at your command. And so it feels good. But in fact, you're not getting good material, because you can't deal closely with the actors. You can't create that tiny little safe world where they can play.
I mean, the reason that you have soundstage and stuff is because the most important thing to have in filmmaking, to the extent that you can get it, is total control. And on a soundstage, you supposedly have total control when you're on the streets doing guerrilla filmmaking, which even if you have control of the city, the fact that you're on the streets and you're in an environment that you can't totally control, it's automatically guerrilla filmmaking. It's very difficult for the actors to do their best work.
Yeah. This was a dangerous place. We won't even go into the number of the stabbings in that little motel.
the condoms.
It was all these prostitutes hanging out on the streets there, and there were people being beaten up. Anyway, second unit shot that shot. First unit was too cowardly. All this stuff in the in these dream sequences is shot at the convention center in Philadelphia, which was a former police train station. It was a 19th century great shed that they had made into a convention center.
This was the most logistically complex thing to shoot in the convention center, because we had to take this convention center and completely make it look like an airport. And then we had to shoot, which was the final sequence of the film and all the dream sequences, in a very, very confined period of time. Because if we could not get back there, we had to take out all the set that we built, which was at a great cost. And if we didn't finish the work, we couldn't get back in there, because they were bringing in a different kind of convention. It was, after all, a convention center and not an airport. And I think the last day that we were there, I think we shot 23.5 hours in order to get the work done.
I mean, these moments, we were talking about it earlier, is that when you're shooting scenes, there's something very exciting about the fact, you know, this is the only chance in the history of the universe that this scene will be shot, these moments will be there. And it really focuses the crew. There's a lot of, not I wouldn't say a lot of, but some directors, you know, like reshooting things, and I'm not one of them, because I haven't actually achieved much in the reshoot. Sometimes you fix a technical problem, but you kind of lose the intensity of the moment that's there, when the entire crew and the actors know this is their only chance of achieving something. It's hard to explain what happens at those moments, because all this talent and energy and years of experience is all focused on these tiny, tiny moments.
One of the things that really further impacted this pressure that we had to get out of the convention center was that this was the first, it's actually the only place in the film where Terry had to work with the young Cole, the little boy that Bruce Willis dreams about, that turns out to be him as a young boy. And I remember when we were casting the film, you and I had a debate about who to pick for that young boy.
It came down to two kids. I mean, there was this kid that came in on the casting who Margie and I just said, that's it, it's fantastic, this kid's wonderful, because he was brilliant, he was a great kid in reality. And I said, well, let's see the rest of the kids. And we saw the last kid. And this last kid was one of those instances where the camera loved him. And I always have this problem of thinking, well, sometimes you go with that, even forget about who the person is in real life. Go with what the camera sees. And he had these beautiful eyes. And I thought, since eyes were going to be so important for the shots that we needed for the dream sequences, let's go with that kid, even though I thought it was totally unfair, because the other kid deserved the part. He was everything you want in a human being, and I went for the Hollywood approach.
Well, interestingly, this was the first film where I actually stayed very removed from the casting process of the supporting actors and the day players, etc., in that I didn't attend any of the casting sessions. And, you know, Terry said, don't worry, Chuck, I'm not going to cut you out of the process. Don't be so controlling. And, I listened to him. But what also happened was it allowed me to be completely objective, because I didn't have anything, vested or any prior experience with seeing these actors when they came in during the reading and having any dialogue with them. And I could just judge by what was on the videotape. And I actually felt, and I understood why Terry really, you know, thought so much of those eyes of that young boy, but I felt that, you know, the audience wasn't ever going to see those eyes if we picked the boy who actually could do it better. And, you know, we debated about this, and ultimately, Terry said, no, I believe that I can get the performance out of the young boy with the big eyes. And I don't know why, but, I, for some reason, and even today, I don't know exactly why I did it, but I just felt that I should make sure that we had access to the boy, the young boy that I thought was actually a better actor. And I actually hired him as an extra specifically to keep him around, because I knew that if we got into trouble with the young boy with the big eyes, that we would never be able to finish the work at the convention center on time. And
this is why Chuck's a good producer, because my job is to think everything is possible and we are invincible. He is the man to cover the asses of all of us. And what was interesting is, of course, we got behind schedule. We were under terrible pressure. And the first kid was there every day trying to get him accustomed to what was going on so he felt comfortable, at ease. And yet, the moment it came for him to walk through the security barrier, it was clear, None of this preparation has worked.
Or if he was going to be able to do it, it was going to take much more time than we had.
Exactly. And luckily, James, the boy who's downstairs, was there and available, and it was a very easy decision. And thank God Chuck had kept him available, because he walked in and he was perfect, and he couldn't ask for better.
But even with that, if you can imagine, we shot 23 and a half hours. Literally, we got out of there with only a half hour to spare.
Yeah, yeah. It was very interesting, this moment with Madeline in the car, choosing not to run away, from Cole. Because in rehearsals, in the original script, she was just constantly dragged along by Cole. And Madeline felt strongly that, you know, the character should have a chance to make a decision to stay with him, because it was more interesting. Then she, in a sense, becomes an accomplice. She's made a choice rather than just being a victim. And in rehearsals, that seemed a great idea, and she was convinced she could pull it off. And when we shot the scene in the car, it was one of those days that things weren't going well, and there was a lot of, it wasn't an inspired day. And I knew how I wanted to shoot it, which is, you know, coming wide and then moving in. We did one take, and I lost confidence in it immediately. And I didn't think it was going to work. We were running out of time, and Roger Pratt said, well, let's break it up. We'll shoot it, you know, because it was more complicated doing it one shot. We'll shoot a couple different angles tighter, which we did. And then we cut it into the film.
Well, we actually ran out of time. We never completed the scene.
That's true. But that moment of her decision was like the crucial thing for me. And we shot it. And we cut it, and we put it in the film, and it was in previews. The audience wasn't buying it. They wouldn't buy this moment of decision. Now, what was interesting is we had used obvious shots. We had been tighter, and the decision was it was cuter. It was more, I don't know what it was, but it wasn't right. And in the end, we ended up going back to the very first take, the one I'd lost confidence in, and that's what's in the film, and it works. And it's something about, the tension that is maintained in a long shot, and even if you're not close to see the detail
on her face,
and it somehow worked, and it was, you know, and we got it. This keeps happening in films. There's a tendency for people to sort of try to believe the director, you know, knows what he's doing all the time, and is a man in control. And the reality is you're constantly losing confidence in things. You know, events take place that make you change things. You're not certain. In the editing, you have that moment of trying to pull it all back together and make sense of it. And sometimes you find you end up going back to the shot you were convinced, you were certain, positive, that wouldn't work. And it's the one that does it. It's very hard. I don't think there are any rules when it comes to making films about how you achieve things.
Well, you know, another really good example of that is we felt that there needed to be, all throughout the film, this subtextual romance that was going on between Madeline and Bruce, or Rayleigh and Cole. And, of course, in the first, leading up to the first preview, we made sure, and I think that you were, in fact, kind of responding to something that, you know, I was kind of like a dog with
a
bone.
We're going to blame Chuck with this one. I mean, this need for romance with big capital letters and lights flashing.
And so you picked takes that were a little bit more romantic, and you used music that was a little bit more romantic. And, you know, in that first preview, it was very clear that one of the biggest criticisms was that the audience was not buying the romance at all.
And what, in fact, you know, from the beginning, David and Jan and myself, I'm going to include, in this one, always argued there was plenty of romance and one didn't have to nail it. And yet, pressure from other sources, which we won't name here, was such that you start losing confidence in this. And it was a very interesting thing. And musically, we had put on more romantic. We were telling the audience what to think. And what we did, we didn't actually change too many shots afterwards. What we changed was the music. By pulling off this definite music and putting in ambiguous music, the audience then had to make up their own minds what was going on, and suddenly it worked.
It started working. All of a sudden it became more romantic.
Yeah, of course. And it's very interesting how, I mean, you know, you look at Spielberg movies and a lot of other movies, everything's telegraphed, everything is, you are told what to feel music by the music all the time. And with Paul Buckmaster working on this, we more and more decided that what we had to do was trying to keep it. It was like a romance. It was trying to become, but never succeeded. It was music that didn't quite make that final leap into real romance. And that's what was interesting.
Because when we had music that was telling you how to feel, it was doing something that no other part of the film was doing. No part of the film really gave you any kind of answers until the very end. And even in the ending of our film, there's a lot of ambiguity of what could or could not be going on.
And what that does, though, is that every member of the audience is having a slightly different experience. I think when you telegraph with music and everything, they have all having the same experience. This one, everybody is making their own choice of what's happening and deciding what's happening. And one of the enjoyable things about the film is after it's all over, when people come out, they're all arguing about really what this meant, what happened there. To me, that's important. I love that, to actually start a discussion, an argument.
Particularly since I think that if you asked Terry, myself, or Dave and Jan exactly what the ending of the film is, you would probably get three different answers.
Mm. I think this is an interesting scene, because this is the one scene that we reshot, and it's indicative of the difficulty of making films when you're working with someone like Bruce, who was asked to go and do reshoots on Die Hard in the middle of this film. Now, he spent, you know, weeks developing James Cole and that character and getting deeper and deeper into it, and suddenly, for this period of 4 days, he was pulled out of it. He had to go back and become John McClane. And we shot this scene on the day before he was to do John McClane. And he had already moved into the John McClane character. And there was nothing one could do to get him out of it. He had shifted over, ready for the next day's work. And it was one of those frustrating days that no communication seemed to be working. And so we just shot the scene and said, that's it. And it was one of the few days I got really angry with the way things were going, and we reshot it. We had to reshoot it ultimately, because after this experience of escaping to do Die Hard, and he eventually got back into this character, he realized that this was wrong, what he had done, and we went and reshot it. And that, what you see in the film, is the reshoot. Not all of it.
No, because it's a combination.
It's a combination, because the kids weren't available, so we actually had to frame the kids out of many of the shots with Cole in it.
This is another one of those background plates that was shot on the stage. This was actually the most difficult of them all to get right. For some reason, and we still never found out, there was some chemical on the actual film that was used. And so it made it very, very difficult for them to do what they do on these computers, which is, you know, painted in around the blue.
Normally what happens is the blue, which you'd see out these out the back windows, would be, you know, that's what you see when we're shooting. We just see blue. Now the in the post-production, you make a mat off that. The camera sees the blue as black. And then once you've made black, you've got a solid mat, and then you can replace it with any image you want. But the problem is the edges of the image have to be clear. She's got hair there, very fine hair that is hard to hold on to. And we had this terrible boiling effect that nobody could work out what was happening. And a lot of the work was then done by hand, actually, just rotoscope, which is, of course, very time-consuming, very expensive bit of work. This scene, again, because we shot it in the soundstage, it was enjoyable, because as far as the relationship was going, I wanted him to get sillier in this scene. And I don't know if people remember the Bickersons, which was a radio show, which is this battling couple. And that was my direction on this one, to play it like the Bickersons. It's like they've been together for quite a while, and they're reached that stage when they can just start, you know, going at each other like an old couple. And this, again, it's a very strong moment, because, again, nothing is said here. It's just in the looks, and we begin to see a change that's taking place in these characters. And Madeline, something is happening there. He's beginning to trust her, a man who doesn't trust anyone, and she's beginning to succumb to something which she can't explain. And for a psychiatrist, that must be the most frustrating thing, to not be able to explain the emotions or the feelings she's experiencing.
This scene we shot, and I remember that it was already starting to become spring.
Yep.
And that we were getting very nervous that we were going to be in a lot of trouble if the leaves sprouted too early for us.
Yeah, this is a scene that I remember starting with more elaborate shots and realized, no, this is the director getting in the way of something that should just be a very simple, direct relationship between these two characters. But what had to happen here was this moment of the two people being that close, smelling, touching, and wanting to go further, and yet not being able to for different reasons. And Bruce has to steel himself, and it's very important that we don't know what's going to happen here. That is he crazy enough? Is he possessed enough that he is going to kill her or harm her? And it's very subtle how it changes from something romantic to something very dangerous. And then, of course, we cut. And this was like a nightmare shoot. This was at night, and it was raining. We had one chance to get this thing, and we were there, and we waited most of the night.
For a small break in the rain.
And we got it, finally, and got the shot. If you notice, there'll be water dripping off these cars, because the team was out there mopping them down. It rained the whole night, except for this tiny, tiny moment when we got the shot. These are the things that drive you crazy, because you plan, all this effort is put into this one moment of this, getting to this house, this place, because there was going to be some display going on there, so we only had it for a moment. We had to somehow get it. And it's whether you hold your nerve and say, we will wait it out, or you make the choice, okay, we'll quit. We'll quit now, and we'll pick it up later. And
but of course, we would have lost that location had we done so.
No. So luckily, the gods were with it. Christopher Plummer! A great man. I wanted somebody who had real weight for this character, because it's such a small part, and it's again trying to create red herrings for the audience so they don't know who the villain is going to be. And you put something like Christopher Plummer in a small part like that, and the audience immediately thinks, well, maybe he's the guy that's going to do it. It's this part has to be bigger, more important, because of the weight of the actor. And I actually wanted to work with Amanda Plummer's father, having worked with her on
Well, I think also, as you said, we needed an actor who was going to give the part a lot of weight, because you hear him talked about for, well, you know, he's basically part of the quest, and when we finally met him, he had to live up to our expectations.
This is a location in Baltimore, which was formerly townhouse of I think it was wasn't it the man who created the Baltimore and Oriole, the B&O Railway. It was a railway tycoon, basically, 19th century railway tycoon whose house it was, and it's now the Engineering Society.
The Engineering Society.
And we went down there for one reason. The spiral staircase that we see in the next shot. I was obsessed with this staircase. It was like a DNA molecule. It was some kind of double helix. It was perfect for the nightmare that had to happen at this point in the scene when Cole begins to, or is told that he's in fact responsible for 5 billion people dying.
Now, was this intentional or not? But that spiral staircase and the opening titles of the Spiral of the 12 Monkeys, did they come out? Did that come out of?
It's all in the back of my mind for these things. I mean, I just know the spiral, this circular, this. These are the things that was behind a lot of what's going on in the film. A lot of that stuff, I think it's fairly subconscious with me, but I just know it's right. It felt right. I mean, and we had to adjust our schedule to do this, just to deal with this one place. Which I think
That's
Chuck
right.
thought I was out of my mind.
But when I saw the spiral staircase, I have to say that, and here it is, the spiral staircase, I have to say that it was truly, knowing what Terry could do with it, it was an exciting thing.
I mean, you start, suddenly everything's turning in on itself to me. It's you know, this is where the architecture and the scene are one and the same thing. Everything is working together. I mean, it also has, you know, echoes of Hitchcock again. It's Vertigo. It's the staircase. And since Vertigo comes in later in the film, subconsciously, I think I'm making these connections.
You know, we ended up initially going to Baltimore and Philadelphia because, of course, that's where the script was written by Dave and Jan. But yet, if you ask them why did they write it for Baltimore and Philadelphia, they can't tell you.
That was what was so bizarre. As we, you know, diligently trying to do what the script demanded. I was desperately trying to not make it my film. I was trying to be just one more hired director coming in to respect the work of the writers, because writers are not normally respected, but coming from writing, I probably give them undue respect these days. But it said Baltimore and Philadelphia, and so we dutifully went there, only to discover that Dave and Jan had never been to either town, that the distances between the town and the original script were totally wrong. There's no reason to spend an overnight trip. It was totally wrong, and yet it turned out to be the right place.
First of all, we never would have been able to be able to finance the film and create the underground world look had we not found those power stations, and the fact of the matter is, they're only in Baltimore and Philadelphia.
And Bruce is wonderful. I mean, he loves doing his own stunts. He loves getting right in there. He's a great fight director. If his career fails as an actor, he can always get a job as a fight director. Because in those moments, he's incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly skilled, and he takes over, and I sort of step back when he decides to start hitting things. The monkey. This is my favorite moment in the film. When I saw that, it took ages trying to get a helmet made for this little monkey, and again, the props, Doug Harlicker and his people made that. And when I saw that shot, it was wondrous. Because here's, again, something we're talking about for a long time beforehand, and you've got to top it when you actually see it. And the audience howls. It's wonderful.
I mean, TV and what's on TV and the commentary of the people on TV, it's almost like another character in the film.
Yeah,
isn't it?
That's right. It's in this scene in particular. I mean, here we got a scene with a guy looking around, and really this terrible news is being talked about on the television, and we sort of leave it. We just drift off it, and yet it's very chilling at that moment when you think that maybe Cole has killed Rayleigh. I mean, I remember reading that in the script and falling for it totally. And then this running through the woods was, again, a kind of a repeat of the time machine mode of this strobe effect. And I love this shot because Bruce is like this hunted animal. His head is about a foot in front of his body when he's running. The whole way he was running that night was quite wondrous. It was a strange bit of woods that we found and worked in. I was going crazy then because I spent the night pulling leaves off trees to make it look wintry.
Well, this was, I think, one of the tensest evenings that we had, because everybody had a slightly different opinion of what Rayleigh's ability to stun Cole would be if she kicked Adam out of the trunk. But in fact, the anger that everybody ultimately had towards each other and being able to, and trying to figure out exactly what the right nuance of the scene was, ended up working wonderfully for the scene when it came time to shoot it.
Well, that often happens, exactly. I mean, what you see on the screen is the result of any number of things that preceded it. And this was one of those. It was a total disagreement about what kind of violence you could perpetrate and what its effect would be.
Human race, not you or Jeffrey or anybody else.
Well, I mean, he was coming from that place, and of course Madeline was coming from the place that if she was furious enough, a kick to his jaw would be effective.
I love this shot because we just stayed here on one shot. Again, we're not cutting. We didn't have time. It was one of those nights where we ran out of time, and so it's just very simple. You shoot it simply. And that's one of the things I enjoyed on this film is not getting too clever sometimes, because I think there's a lot of films now that are done with so many clever cuts and shots and angles, you never get a chance to just let the characters do it for you. And it was important to just let the characters do some of these scenes, not to intrude with what the camera is doing or clever editing is doing. Let it be simple.
This is also one of my favorite moments here when he disappears at the end.
Yeah.
Bruce
got very funny with that.
He was just fabulous.
Fabulous, I agree. And he was just this kid, and he started leaping about. And then, in post-syncing, when we started putting the voice on over this, he came up with more ideas, you know. And
I think it's a real insight into Bruce's soul here.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a side that, again, his career hasn't been based on revealing this side. And so he's slightly nervous doing this, but when he lets go, he's so sweet and so innocent, and not any of the tough guy that we normally associate with him. And I think that's true about Bruce. He's a really sweet, lovely, decent guy, under all of that macho facade that he shows the world. And Madeline, I love this scene with her, because again, cutting from that kind of madness and silliness to this beautiful face that is so strong and so intelligent and so... Every take she did on this day, in fact, almost always, there were different colorings. She's, as an actress, for a director, you can't ask for any more because each take is slightly different. They're all within the character, but she gives you all of these various colorings, these little choices that in the editing, you've got everything you'd ever want to work with, and you can just frame shape these scenes. A lot of actors don't do that. They give you the same thing again and again and again, but she finds little ways of doing it.
That's right, but I always thought that you guys talked about whether or not she should do a little bit more in take two versus take three.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, that's it, but the fact that she can do it is the thing. A lot of actors can't do that. And they,
this range.
And she would do it. You'd talk about it, but then what she would do would always surprise you. That's the exciting thing of watching a take unfold and see, good God, look what she's doing now. Oh, that's fantastic. The reading on that, just the emphasis on that syllable. Oh, I couldn't have imagined that. You do that, and she's one of those actresses that surprise you constantly. You never feel she's acting. That's the other thing. And maybe that's a bad thing sometimes because, you know, critics, the world, like to see acting. They like to be aware that somebody's acting. Madeline, I never felt that. I feel she's so transparent, I just believe her. Right? And in a strange way, I don't think she gets the credit she deserves for, because she's not showy about what she does.
No, she is very, very subtle. The next scene that comes up, the scientist singing.
Well, yes, this came out of...
I would have to say that this is definitely a Gilliam signature.
There was something in the original script. Every time Cole came back to the future, it was this dark, dismal place. He was always being punished. He was always being attacked by them. There was never any relief from it. It was never a moment when he had actually achieved something, and it felt it was important that he's actually achieved something this time around, and they should reward him. And then we came up with the idea of singing Blueberry Hill, and it was just, and it got sillier and sillier, and in a strange way, it becomes even more nightmarish, because now, what is really going on here? This is getting very strange. And I love this idea of taking this painting, and we use the music from Key West, the Florida Keys, which was Santo and Johnny.
Sleepwalking.
And all these elements are tying together, and you're looking at something, what is this? And then suddenly you realize it's a painting, and where is he? And the future has now been transformed. It's almost Pythonesque, I'm afraid.
But, you know, actually when Terry got involved, which was somewhere between the second and third draft of the screenplay, well, it was actually after the first draft of the screenplay, Universal, a creative executive there by the name of Barry Isaacson, he actually slipped the script to Terry because nobody really thought that after the Brazil experience, Terry would possibly do another film with Universal. And Terry responded to the screenplay, but at that time it looked like he was going to be involved in one of two other films. But nevertheless, our desire to have him direct this was so strong that I did get on an airplane and I flew to London and met with him. And
I got a free lunch. And I'm a sucker for free lunches.
But we made this kind of handshake agreement that he would give his notes on this draft and David Jan would go away and write them. And however long it took, and then we'd send him the next draft of the screenplay, which was the second draft. And if those other two films hadn't moved forward appreciably, he might cast his lot with us. And that's exactly what happened. But most of the changes that occurred in the screenplay after Terry got involved had to do from the point in the story of when Cole came back to the future for the second time, which was exactly the point that Terry made, which was it was a little bit redundant that he was always going back and always being treated poorly by these scientists.
It seemed to me, especially in this instance, that he goes back and he gets everything that he wants. He gets a pardon, he gets a clean sheet, and so by the terms of that world, he's being treated as a hero, and yet he makes his choice to leave it all behind, to come back, to risk everything because he's in love with Rayleigh.
Which was a great point because it really increases the stakes for Cole. There was no the dramatic stakes for Cole if he was being treated as a prisoner, even at this point when he had come close to the 12 monkeys. of course he's going to want to go back and be with her because he's being treated poorly. So Terry made the point, and it was completely embraced by myself and Dave and Jan, that he has to have an opportunity to have a good life here in the future, to the extent life can be good in the future, so that he's really risking something when he decides to go back.
And there's also something that I'm not sure if it works or not, but it's because the scene is so mad, it's like the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, it's something out of Alice in Wonderland, you maybe begin to think, well, maybe it is in his mind when he comes back and says, I can talk to them, I tricked them. You know, there's that sense that, this is... It's a surprise for the audience. They're seeing a different view of the future, just when you think you know exactly what's going to happen in the future.
And of course, the fact that at this point, the two characters are exactly, the two lead characters, Cole and Rayleigh, they're completely changing places.
That's right. Now, that's what I loved about the script. I mean, that, you know, they both have an idea of what the world is, and they both, at the same time, change their viewpoint to that of the other person. And it's extraordinary. I think for a psychiatrist to completely come apart, you know, and I love that speech about, you know, we're the new priests, we're the ones that can explain the world, we have the answers, and then it all starts slipping away, and the fact that there are no clear answers is wonderful, and this whole latter part of the script is wonderful, how it flip-flops back and forth about who's right, who isn't, who believes what, and I think for the audience it's happening as well. It was the trick was to try to get the audience to be as lost as the characters, in a sense, to go right with them.
You know, another one of the things that you told me early on when we started the pre-production process was that the deeper you get into the making of a film, the more what the film's about becomes what the production experience is about for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's why this was such a painful film.
Philly P.D., I'm sorry to call
you. Know, this is a strange experience I find every time one makes a movie, is that the making becomes the same as the movie itself, what it's about. And what happened on this, which was extremely disconcerting and painful and awful and made the whole experience a kind of nightmare, was that we kept getting lost in where we were in time.
Well, you say we, but the fact of the matter is it was you.
And Madeline. No, Madeline and I had this one night when we shot the scene, after shooting the scene with Frank Gorshin, where she says, you know, we're the priests and I'm losing my faith. She called me, I think, a day later and said, you know, I think that was wrong. I think I pitched it emotionally too high for where the scene is in the film. I said, no, it's perfect because it takes place at this point in the story. And she said, no, it doesn't. It takes place earlier. I said, what are you talking about? And what it had done, we'd actually got it wrong. We constantly found these things in the wrong place. The reality was that we went back and reshot that scene. And what's in the film is, in fact, what we did the first time. Because
that's right. Yeah. She hadn't pitched it too high.
No, but
it needed that.
Yeah, it's that thing we were able to discover once we put the film together that it did need that extra pitch. It's, I think, for some actors, they're not used to working, you know, in the kind of angles that I use. I mean, when you're talking about wide-angle lenses and the look of the film, it becomes rather monumental sometimes, and actors have to act slightly differently within them to maintain, you know, their position in the film. And I think that's what happened. I mean,
but you know, when we started, you know, on the adventure of making this movie, as I said, I think earlier in this commentary, you had said to me, be careful because as we get closer and closer to production, you'll find that the scenes will grow. Make sure you have enough money in the budget and you count on the fact that these things will grow. The other thing that you did say to me, which means you had an awareness that it must have happened in your other films, was that you have a tendency to, as the production of the film goes forward, you have a tendency to become emotionally caught up in the making of the film as the lead character is emotionally caught up. And it was very clear that one of the reasons that you weren't having a particularly great time was because you were getting confused.
I was cold. Is basically what happened. But it always happens. I mean, when they were scripts that I'd written myself, there was always an autobiographical element to it. That's why I write things. You know, you write things that mean something to you, that you've been affected by. And so I was always the main character. It gets more complicated in Fisher King because there were two main characters, Jeff and Robin, and I became a bit schizophrenic at that one, not sure which one I was. This one was a bit easier because I knew I wasn't Jeffrey, even though I really am. But you get lost in it, so the whole process becomes less of this mechanical exercise. It's going through a very complex, disturbing emotional experience when you're making it. And And maybe, I don't know, I find it somehow translates to the film. And I don't want to be... It's like when you're doing a painting or writing a bit of music. You've got to become the thing. That's the only way you really get it. And with film, there's the possibility, that because of the technical nature of it, because of the number of people you're involved with, that you can step back and be more Olympian in your approach. But I've never been able to do that.
I guess it was really a very positive thing having a guy that was as calm and as objective in the editing room like Mick was, because he was able to interpret kind of what you were going through emotionally and make sure that as he was cutting the film, he...
Yeah, it's very important to have an editor who is on the right wavelength, who understands it, who is... Because there, you know, we're out in the front line, and the bullets are zinging past our heads, explosions everywhere, and he's back in the editing room taking this material that we've done and put it together, and you've got to trust him to be a good judge on whether we're covering it all. What Mick said, Mick said was, make sure you've packed enough socks for the journey, and what he meant by that was that there were a lot of scenes in the script that we weren't certain about whether we needed or not, because, wait, that seems redundant. We've said that. We've been there before. And then he said, no, just keep shooting them, because we don't know until we get in the editing room whether we're going to need those scenes. And so we packed all the socks that Dave and Jan had written.
But I actually think, you know, even though the film was cut down to, you know, 2 hours and 9 minutes, I guess, including the credits, I think that we used at least every single scene that was shot.
I think so. I can't think of anything that isn't in there. I mean, we really, yeah, no.
I mean,
we
some
did.
Of them we shortened greatly.
Oh,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But I'm saying, you know, there's no real montages in this film.
No, I think it's, I mean, but looking back on all my films, it's kind of like that. I mean, I'm actually very efficient, despite the fact it doesn't seem that. When we're working, but it's kind of there. I don't waste things. I mean, just on another level, is if we're building sets, I only want to see, you know, an inch more than we're going to use in the film.
True.
And it's very hard to express that to people. They don't believe that, because, again, in films, all the departments have to cover themselves. Their job is to cover their ass, and they don't want to be caught in a situation where the director on the day says, wait, where's that? And it isn't there. And that, of course, always happens.
Well, I remember because, you know, as we were doing the budgeting for the set design, you know, and you were saying, you know, I promise you that you know, if you give me just an inch over what I need, and Jeffrey Breakoff, the production designer, was very nervous because, you know, you're shooting with these wide-angle lenses all the time,
yeah.
And he's going, oh, my God, if you turn around and I don't have anything there for you, or if you decide that you want, you know, to shoot on an 18 instead of a 20 and I don't have enough set there for you, And you said, I'll never do that to you,
yeah.
And in fact, you were really, you never did.
No, I don't, because, I mean, nobody believes that, because I think most directors, you know, do behave in the way that people think they're going to. And yet, I do scream and shout occasionally, but it's usually not for those reasons. It's different kinds of frustration. But my fear always is of going over budget and losing control of the film. To me, the totality is the thing, and ultimate control is what it's all about, because you don't want to spend a couple of years of your life and then have it taken away from you because you went over budget, because you went, you lost control of that. And, you know, and that's what we did, you know, you and I and Madeline all put up, you know, a great chunk of our
salary. And Bruce did the movie for no money, but
yeah.
Essentially just the back end, and Brad also, considering what his star status had become, also did it for very low money. And really, if all of us hadn't have done that, we wouldn't have been able to make the film. That's true.
And it's important to keep control, because, I mean, I think that's my biggest fear, is that one puts oneself in a vulnerable position where the studio or whoever can come in, usually very nervous, frightened people with no particular talents, and make the final choices. And you see it happen on so many films. And then... Yeah, the only advantage of those is the director later, you know, 10 years later, can release the director's cut and say that was his, which I resent enormously, because if you put your name on the film, you're the director, and that's your cut. And if you don't think that's your cut, if that's not the film you set out to make, then don't put your name on it. And yet, they have the benefit of being able to do director's cuts. Mine are what you see. That's the end of it.
Now, another thing that you do sometimes, which is, I guess, Lloyd Phillips coined as the hamster factor. And you do, you know, the set will be ready to go, and you'll have taken, you know, a fair amount of time to work with the production designer and the DP and the actors and the background sort of paint in what the action's going to be, if you will. And then you'll get focused on some small thing that none of us are really sure is the point of the scene, but you'll get focused on it. Now, what is that all about?
I don't know. It's this obsession with detail, with juxtaposing, putting little things in that are surprising to the audience that people will find in years to come. I mean, these are sort of like archaeological digs is what these films are. They can be, I don't like making films that you only watch once. I like the fact that almost everything I've been involved with, you can watch again and again and find new things in there. And there's little things, and there's always this sense of irony or quirkiness. So in the case of the hamster, this particular hamster, was this scene early on when Bruce is naked in his chair, extracting blood from his arm, and it's this huge, you know, metallic set, this huge thing. And with the implication that there's this very elaborate technology behind it all, and something just struck me funny that in the midst of all this very heavy, machinery, inhuman thing, is something as simple and silly as a little hamster running in. I think it to me, it adds a human element to it. It adds a reality to things. Now, it may not be worth the cost of the time it takes to get the hamster to do it, and I think all the production department would agree on that one. But, you know, sometimes I feel I've got to be on.
But it does, I have to say, in terms of the hamster factor, it does make I guess the satirical commentary on the moment, which is what your films are about.
There's all of that. I mean, I just love the detail in the thing. I mean, there's things going on in this room that you don't even notice, but when we're setting up the shot, you know, there's transvestites in this room. You don't realize that, but there are transvestites in there. And that's Roger Pratt back there, the lighting cameraman, tying his shoes. So even the crew gets into the film as key characters. And it's kind of setting that little world there of detail that we, the crew and the actors, can enter into on that moment. And for the audience, it may make no difference, but I think it does for the actors, for us working there, and we begin to believe something, and little things come out. And it's like setting up some things you don't know what the result is going to be, because there might be a surprise, an accident. And those are the moments that are really exciting, when you've prepared everything, you've got all these elements in place, and then it goes wrong, and you've got to fake it, you've got to get out of it. Now, if we're really good, if we're really talented, you know, the crew and the actors, we usually find really interesting solutions to those problems, and they're fresher, they're more alive, because to me, one of the problems of films is it's such a long, extended process of planning in advance and getting everything just right, that it can have that element of just being too mechanical by the time you get around to shooting it. So I like the fact that there may be a bit of chaos, there may be a bit of a disaster, but it's always within parameters, because the things that we've put there on that set have all been chosen well in advance, and we don't know always what they're going to lead to, but they might lead to an interesting situation. Here's my other favorite scene. I love this scene. From a writing point of view, I think this scene is breathtaking. The range it goes from something very touching and lost to danger, to madness, to comedy, and then back to something very, very emotional and pathetic and sad and sweet all at once. And it's a brilliant bit of writing, I think. It's almost an entire movie in this one scene, what the characters go through.
Well, you know, I remember that we had scheduled, I think, to be here shooting this scene over 2 days. And much of the first day was spent really not shooting very much of anything, but just really you working with Bruce and Madeline to get the performance right, because, you know, I think this is the key moment where, you know, the two characters sort of recognize that they are completely in this together.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's right, and they're locked together. They're kind of in a war that's taking place that nobody's even aware of, and they're the only two survivors almost, or the ones trying to get through it. It's a shock, because they both see their worlds beginning to, the ones they've been created in their heads, coming apart. Their explanations of reality are just falling apart all over this thing. But the idea of doing a scene and having become so tender and then exploded with this pimp coming in and this incredible, ridiculous violence is going on is the thing that I just love. I think, again, for a scene for Bruce, because he had to find this very still and totally vulnerable character. And what was interesting, I mean, we did have a long discussion about when the pimp comes in, because his attitude was, if somebody pulls a knife on my girl, I'm going to kill him immediately. I said, well, Cole can't do that. Cole is lost in his confusion of what is real and what isn't.
He's not even sure that the pimp coming in is real.
Yeah, and also, I said, Dave and John have written a really good speech for the pimp, and we don't want to get in the way of that. So it's a combination of things, and it's that moment of again, the audience thinking, you know, Bruce is going to leap to his feet and go into action, and it doesn't happen, and you're sort of, you're hung in space for a moment. What is going to go on? I mean, Madeline here is like a Madonna. I mean, this is like, and I wanted to feel that way. It had to be so, it's not sexual. It's not even romantic in the way one would normally do a romantic scene. It's just, it's a mother and a child almost.
Yeah, it's very maternal. And, but incredibly warm and affecting.
Yeah, and I think, I remember showing Bruce that scene, after we'd shot it, and, because he intended not to look at what he was doing. He kept saying he wanted to see it, but he never really turned up to look at it. And I think he was genuinely surprised and impressed how little he had to do
that he could get away with.
He could just be there. And for an actor to just realize you don't have to do anything is such a major leap forward rather than being always busy, always doing something.
You know, one of the things that I didn't really participate very much in was, and I don't really know how much you dealt with Beecroft or Crispian and Roger on it, was the use of the different colors in these sets.
A lot of the color, I mean, the future, I always wanted to have a nicotine look to it. It wanted to look like the inside of a smoker's lungs. Is what I just had this in my head. And it sort of drifted through a lot of things. It, like this scene is kind of back into those colors. These are Jeff's colors. Jeff's a good colorist. Crispian is wonderful at choosing things like the carpet, that weird roller device on the right there, which was for people's backs. And Crispian, as a set decorator, dresser, whatever the term you want to use, is quite brilliant because he's English, and he has the quirkiness of the English that he puts in odd and strange juxtaposed pieces that are surprising. I mean, he gets full credit for Bruce in the future in the hospital when he's rewarded and he's in the bed and there's the little teddy bears on the blanket. Now that's wonderful, and it's kind of as if, and this is in a way a problem and it's also their benefits as well, is that they all have seen the kind of films I've done, so they were kind of making a Terry Gilliam film and throwing in all the things that they expect to be in my films, and yet I was trying not to make a Terry Gilliam film. I was trying to do a David and Jan
screenplay,
yeah, and trying to avoid my quirkiness, and yet I failed miserably at that.
Well, no, I was also surprised at how much deference you did give to their screenplay.
Hold up, poor a fucking crazy dentist.
The sense of responsibility that one has is, you know, it's like they've given birth to a child, and now it's being handed over to these foster parents, the director, who's going to raise this thing badly, not the way it was intended. And so I feel very responsible. It's two sides to it. On one hand, it makes me wary of doing some of the things I would do instinctively sometimes, because I don't want to impose my particular weirdness on what they're doing. And we had a constant dialogue, all of us, you know, discussing these things. Even when we were shooting, the phone would be ringing. And sometimes these were not happy conversations because sometimes I went directions they didn't want me to.
That's true, but by and large it all worked out. What's really interesting is that you had all this deference to Dave and Jan. You didn't want to ruin their screenplay. You wanted to take care of their baby. And, of course, even though all they got from Chris Marker was the inspiration, they had all this deference to Le Jeté, and it was so important to them.
Yeah.
Even that it was completely not contractual, nor was it with you. You're a Final Cut filmmaker. You could have done whatever you want, but everybody had this deference for the source material, and actually, I think it worked to the benefit of the film this time.
I think it's good. It's also a good way of passing the buck. So when it doesn't work, I can blame them, and if it doesn't work, they can blame Chris. It's very important to establish who to blame on a film. I used to always like to have a scapegoat, somebody designated scapegoat, so whatever went wrong, that person would get it. And usually it's the smallest, weakest person.
When we were doing the first previews, I guess, and the results were not were not that great. That were you looking to see who you could point the finger at that time?
No, it was too late, unfortunately. I mean, I was completely wrong-footed on that one because I remember sitting at that screening in Washington, and as it was coming to a close, constantly coming up to Mick, whispering, saying, it's working, it's working. You could see the audience was just riveted. Their heads had stopped moving, especially towards the last two reels. They were just into it. And I was convinced we had really done it. It just was a cracker. It was fantastic. And then the cards came in and crashed. They betrayed us once again. It's a very strange process because these people are not real people. They're people who have the time to hang around shopping malls to get free tickets to previews, it seems to me. And it's a very strange moment of empowering people, too, which they kind of take advantage of. It's a chance, you know, they can actually make, have an influence on the kind of films that are made and what is made. And it's very strange because I find when you, I think I'm good at watching an audience or listening or experiencing what the audience is experiencing, and I'm often confused with these things where you can feel it's working, they're with it, they're laughing, and then you get the cards and it seems to be very different from what they seem to be experiencing. It's almost as if they're put into a situation where they have to comment, where they, it's a test, and in many ways, you hear them talking in the discussion group afterwards, and they're more, they sound like studio executives, they sound like marketing experts, they're taking on a role that is greater than what is being asked of them. We just want to know their opinion, their own opinion, not how it should be sold, what the general public are going to think of it, their opinion. And they take on this greater role, and they get sort of swept up in it.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in the preview process, not necessarily a believer in, you know, that one should be completely wedded to what the so-called research numbers say or what the audience gives you, you know, precisely from the cards that are written. But I'm a big believer in the sense that you can glean very, very important information. And we
did.
And different than the, you know, you did, or we did, our share of screenings in the UK with friends, other filmmakers, you know, people that we think would come in, not necessarily but with a bias. And while we got some good things from them, I don't think we got as much as we would have gotten from a, nor that we got different things.
I think what's interesting, and we were lucky because our screenings were not attended by a lot of nervous studio executives. I think the difficult thing with those screenings is it's how the information is interpreted and then how it's used and what kind of pressure is put on the filmmaker at that point. And usually you're surrounded by very nervous film executives who have a few moments of power in the process, and that's at the beginning when they say yes or no, and then at the end. And for the editor, the director, and the producers, we're at our most vulnerable at this point. We've been with it a long time, and we know secretly that we aren't sure ourselves anymore. We've been blinded by the amount of time and energy we've spent on this thing. And so we're not certain. And then the results come in, and either you're ecstatic or you're just crushed. And then the trick is to try to work out what that information means, what they're really saying, and where the problem really lies. Because they say, the problem is here. Often the problem is two reels before. But it requires a certain a time of feeling confident or a time when you're not going to be taken over by, you know, the studios.
Well, you know, you and I, we made a decision early on. And maybe it was because, you know, you had worked with them before. This was to allow Buffy Shutt and Kathy Jones, the heads of marketing at Universal, see the picture very early. I think you had worked with them on Fisher King, and I guess you had a good relationship with them. And I had some personal history with them. And so we brought Buffy and Bill Loper over, I think, very, very early on. I think your very first cut, they saw the film, and they reacted very positively. And then Kathy was with us in Washington for that first preview. And I have to say, and what was pretty extraordinary, at least for me, I don't know if you got this also, but when we got the numbers of that first preview, and they were not very good, in the exact opposite role of what studio people are expected to do, Kathy came up to me and said, I just want to tell you, this movie is fantastic. And, you know, don't let these cards spoil for you what is really a terrific film, and don't go overboard and change the things that shouldn't be changed just because you had a bad screening. It doesn't mean anything, and we can get this film open, and if we get it open, it's going to be a satisfying experience.
I think we really had a very good experience. There's no question about that. And that's the first time I've had one of those in my career. So it was a very pleasant surprise. But I do think, and my fear always at that stage in the film, and it's not just, you know, executives and all, it's my own fear that because what nobody understands is the directors want to have as a big a hit as the executives want to have a bit. And yet I won't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And yet, so I know, and I know in the past under those heavily pressured situations, I've made some choices that weren't the right choices because I panicked, and I'm always frightened of doing that.
Well, I remember because I did a rather lengthy memo, which I faxed to you before I came over for us to talk about it and what I thought needed to be done with the picture. And I know Dave and Jan did their own memo, and you were thinking about it, and Mick was thinking about it. And I think that you were really, and rightly so, very conscious of making sure that, you know, the whole film was one of complexity and subtlety, and the changes needed to be done with that completely in mind, and to truly believe that we had made a quality film, and a film that an audience would like, and so therefore the changes had to be small and not broad.
I think so. I mean, and one of the problems is you often find, you know, that suddenly at that stage they're trying to turn the film into another kind of film is the pressure. I mean, this is not Mission Impossible, nor will it ever be Mission Impossible, no matter how much one deals with it. I think what's interesting here is the Hitchcock section of the film intrigues me because the idea of going to a cinema and watching a film that is relating to what their situation is quite wonderful in the script. And what intrigued me was the fact that, you know, the Kim Novak character is called Madeline, and there's Madeline Stowe.
But that was just serendipity, wasn't it?
Yeah, but there's a lot of it here, because the other thing is in the script, Rayleigh was blonde, and when with her disguise, she put on a black wig. Madeline, being dark-haired, had to put on a blonde wig, so suddenly we came into the foyer, we're in a Hitchcock movie. It's like...
Oh, yeah, because she's like Kim Novak.
She's a Hitchcock blonde. Now, what's really interesting in this scene is Mick put the Vertigo music on it. He just pulled off on the soundtrack a bit of Vertigo and stuck it on. We had a problem with a wow and flutter on that, and we had to go to another CD, another performance of it, to replace the music. And to find the bit of music, we had to go back to the video, which nobody had looked at. You know, I haven't seen Vertigo in 20 years. And we came to find where that music came from, which scene, and it's the scene where Kim Novak appears blonde. For the first time, transformed, and what we discovered is the cuts between Jimmy Stewart and her are identical to the cuts between Madeline and Bruce. The exact same rhythm, the same cuts, everything is going on, and then it got even stranger because I'd forgotten how that scene ended, and the scene ends, they embrace, and the whole room turns around them, and we're suddenly at the mission. Now, what we shot in the foyer of that cinema, which was circular and always struck me as like a carousel merry-go-round shape, we actually did shoot the end of that scene where they embrace, and we put them on a turntable, and the whole room spins around them. We cut that out of the film. But that was just extraordinary. It was almost like the ghost of Hitchcock was making this whole section of the film. And, you know, the scene in the... This is all very Hitchcock-like. And you get to the... I think we get to the air terminal, and it's kind of like, you know, North by Northwest. We're moving into Hitchcock land, and yet it was never in the script that way, and it seemed to just grow out of it. And I think there's a kind of subconscious knowledge of those kinds of films that starts, you know, raising its ugly head or her beautiful head at that point. And I'm not aware of it, but it's only after we've done it that we realize what we've done. Actually, we should comment about some of those animals there, the escaping animals. We did have a real tiger and real elephants and real bears in Philadelphia, loose and running around. But the giraffes were impossible to bring there, so they were done on a computer.
And of course, the flamingos were also done on a computer.
Correct. And it's that mixture that's kind of interesting, where you use some real and some fake, and hopefully the audience can't see the join.
You know, as we are approaching here the climax of the film, I just want to get back to a minute about, you know, something else that came out of that first preview besides you know, in the our decision to stick with the process and believe in the film and make subtle changes as opposed to broad stroke. The other thing that came out, which was a first for me, was the concept that we needed to educate the audience about what they were going to see before they saw it.
Yeah.
And that, and out of that came the whole campaign of our movie is about a riddle. Our movie is about discovering something and finding out something. What is the meaning of the dream? Let's make the marketing campaign the same. And that's when we hit upon the logo and only coming out with the logo of the 12 monkeys, which is so prominent in the movie because, after all, it's the logo or the mark, really, that Cole is looking for.
Because I think what was difficult is this is not a genre movie. It doesn't fit into any genre. And you try to reduce it to something simple, you can't. It just disappears. It falls apart. And so it seemed right that rather than being specific, the more mysterious we could be, let them know this is a puzzle, this is a conundrum, you're going to have to work this one out. And the more we could do that and prepare them, the better. I think it's the most dangerous thing is to bring an audience into the cinema with the wrong expectations and then, you know, and then disappoint them. But if you let them know that it's going to be intelligent, you might have to work at this one. Every time they kept trying to say, you know, science, sci-fi, thriller, all of those. It's not those things. I think it's a very hard
film. Right, it has elements of them, but it's not really a genre.
And it's what bothers me so much about modern filmmaking, is that things have to be reduced to a very simple idea, and I like making films that have a lot of complicated ideas, things you can't reduce, things that don't make life necessarily easy for the marketing people. Why should we, you know, we're filmmakers, we're not supposed to be making life easy for marketing people, and that's what was wonderful that Buffy and Kathy and everybody rose to the occasion. They all saw that's the way to do it.
So that's when we came up, or they came up with what was a two-prong campaign. The first prong was what we called the teaser, which is where the mark was shown at, you know, on billboards, on buses, but it was just the 12 monkeys mark and, you know, an oblique phrase, you know, they're coming. Well, who are they? What is that sign? What does all that mean? That raised the question. That started the riddle. And when, you know, finally the answer, of course, was, well, the movie is coming. The movie's 12 Monkeys, and it stars, you know, Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, Brad Pitt. And it's a Terry Gilliam film. But I think that really helped a lot in educating the audience in terms of the fact that they were going to see a movie that didn't lay out for them what the ending was going to be in the first 5 minutes. And I think I think
is what's important. I do think the public has been, you know, their expectations have been so lowered over the years. I mean, what they think a movie is and what, you know, how complex a movie can be has been simplified, lowered. I mean, the films of the 40s and the 50s wouldn't be made now. They're complex films, and people would say, oh, but it won't work. And so there's been a dumbing down of the audience and its expectations. And to me, what intrigued me was the idea of making a film that could be a popular film, a successful commercial film, that is a complex thing. It's a way of re-educating the public to what you can expect in a movie. And they don't all have to be just simple cartoons. I don't know. I think this... Actually, what's your... Ooh, look, that's Jose. now, I think this part of the film is, to me, the moment... It's just extraordinary. I remember when we first did a cut of this thing, we looked at it in Baltimore before we went to see if we got all the shots. I remember sitting down at the scene back and no sound on it, nothing, and just, it's riveting. You can feel this whole thing building. All the pieces of the puzzle are now coming together. All the things you didn't know. Why was that in the film? What was that about? Suddenly it's all click, 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 and there's like no way out. The bars are coming down. The escape routes are being blocked. And I remember getting sick to my stomach, feeling it's just, this is awful. And there's a sense, I think, which I like for the audience, is they think they're beginning to know what's coming, and they don't want to believe it, because we got Bruce, we can't go kill Bruce, and all, I mean, it's just something like, and it's playing with the idea of who these people are, in a sense, so they're more than just Cole, it's Bruce Willis, and he's about to die, and this can't be. What was interesting here is, you know, building an air terminal, one of the things you want is lots of signs for airlines, and we, as you do in movies, to save money, you try to get people to give you things for free, to advertise in your film. And we couldn't get any airlines to give us any of their signage, which it would cost them nothing. They would get free advertising, and we'd save a bit of money because of a murder at an airport. Not on a plane, at an airport. And they're so frightened about this now.
Yeah, any kind of negative connotation is something, you know, that people who are trying to sell things don't want to be associated with. So what we thought was going to be, because we had big stars, a very big promotional youth film turned out to be not quite as significant.
There's something about this terminal, because all this, the new architecture, all this marble, it was like a mausoleum to me. And when, you know, Cole first sees it, you see these great towering marble towers like a tomb, and yet there's a tunnel there, this tunnel of light. It's like the light one sees as one dies in you know, most near-death experiences as described by the participants. It was quite extraordinary. I mean, this was the day that with these crowds, it was our big crowds, and that was. That's pretty painful when you're dealing with. I think we had 1,000 people, didn't we? Or did we?
We had 500 over 2 days.
Yeah,
but still, it was.
And it's a huge space.
Yeah.
David Morse, we've got to talk about David because this is one of the finest actors in America today, and playing this part, this scene. I remember when we shot this, that it was so chilling and so touching that the crew applauded at the end of it. It's the only time they ever did that, because there's such. A concentration. This guy is so extraordinary as an actor, and you don't often feel that. You feel people doing their job, but he looks like Howdy Doody, frankly.
You mean the moment when he opens the vial the subtlety of him looking around in the air as it releases.
And he did something that wasn't really in the script, that moment of looking around and realizing it's probably one of the last things he's going to see, because he's now sacrificed himself the minute he smelled it. And it's a very touching moment for, you know...
For the bad guy.
The bad guy who's about to wipe out 5 billion people, and yet I care for him. And
well, it's just very real.
Yeah.
He's not arch, he's not... stock in any way,
no.
Even though he's completely chilling.
Yeah, and it's actually it's very hard to talk about this because it's so riveting, I find. But I mean, even then, you know, we throw in cheap jokes, like at the end with his underwear that when he's called back and it's his underwear. In fact, that was one of the most difficult parts of the film, deciding exactly what kind of underwear he would wear. These are the moments that are not normally talked about in books on film directors.
Of course, what's about to come up here is the reason that we thought when we went to Washington that preview was going to tell us what the ending of the film should be, which is... should David Morse be on an airplane or not? Should we show the one of the scientists, the woman scientist?
And this is the biggest argument that went all through the film, because Nick Audsley, myself, Madeline Stowe, all agreed that the film would end on the exchange of looks between the boy and her. There was no way we could top that emotionally. That was it. The script, of course, had the scene in the plane with the scientist and David Morse's character, and then the scene afterwards in the parking lot. And I was convinced we were just going to end that moment of the boy and Rady looking at each other, and I didn't want to shoot the other scenes. And you, in your tenacity, in your role as Mr. Tenacious, kept going, no, we got to do this, we got to do this. I'm not going to use it. I don't want to do it. Got to do it. So we shot the scene in the plane, and we did it with some cheap set that we grabbed some bit of a plane. And I shot it, and it was really good. I mean, I knew we had shot that scene as well as you could do it. It did the job. David was fantastic, and it was a chilling and wonderful, really good scene. But I still knew we weren't going to use that. And then the scene that follows that was the scene in the airport with the boy, which in the script, I didn't know how to do it, how to visually top these moments.
Well, because you didn't, I think what you told me at that time was you didn't want to go from the slow motion that we're seeing here right now to the regular time action on the airplane. Then you didn't feel you could go back to the slow motion, and you certainly didn't want to end the movie on the airplane.
Right. And the parking lot wasn't interesting. I couldn't see what I honestly couldn't see what the shot should be to do it. And so I remember what we did. Roger Pratt, myself, and Mark Edgerton, the first assistant, agreed on the way to work one morning we were going to create an incredibly expensive shot, because now we were creeping into the contingency, and we knew Chuck, the responsible producer, the man concerned with finances, would have to say no, because we were going to invent a really expensive shot. And so we got one crane, and we put another crane on top of it. And then we needed a parking lot with an infinite number of cars, the entire universe of cars. And by the time we'd assembled what we were going to do and then presented it to Chuck, we knew we were safe. We would never have to shoot that. And of course, he said yes. But what it did do in that moment of trying to be perverse, trying to stop something, we did actually invent the shot that worked. And this great sweeping shot from a great height where you see thousands of cars, everything, down to the boy's face. And I think it's wonderful. And it worked, but it was done for the wrong reasons. It was done out of an attempt to stop the shot. But it often works that way. Like, it's the dynamic of a film that always intrigues me, how that happens, how we arrive at these things. But then it came down, even with the editing, we weren't certain, and it was one of the things with the previews. We did two versions, one with the scene of the scientist and one without. And even now, it still is very interesting, because your reading of the scene is different than mine, what it means and what it's saying. And what it does do, I find with more people than not, is it creates confusion, which I was nervous about. Who is the woman? Is it the scientist? It asks, it opens up questions.
And the reason that it opens up those questions is because of an ad-lib line that she says,
yes,
which is insurance.
No, that was in the script. Insurance was in the script.
Oh, that's right.
It was always in there.
That's right. But
they don't understand it.
And then, didn't I come to you and ask you to do one without her saying insurance?
Probably.
And didn't you refuse?
Probably. Because I thought insurance was wonderful.
Because you wanted the ambiguity.
Yes. And it's very good. But it sets up, people come out and they argue about this. What is strange is they can see that Bruce is 40 years old and the boy is 8, but they somehow ask about the scientist. I mean, is she there in this time? Is she going to grow up to be the lady later? But she's the same age. How? So it's very strange, the kind of short-circuiting that starts happening at this point in the film in people's minds, because they're getting information you wouldn't normally, and they don't want to believe it, and they refuse to.
Well, I think also, you know, because she could either be there to save the future, she could be there to save the present, or she could be there in cahoots with him. Right.
What nobody wants to believe is that 5 billion people will die.
Because of the natural instinct of people to believe,
yes,
in the positive.
And the fact that seems in the short term to be a disaster, but in the long term, it's good for the people, you know, 40 years in the future, because they will reclaim the world. But, you know, it's like agriculture. You've got to chop the plants down, dig them into the ground, and in the future, you know, great shoots will sprout up. There should be something on that music at the end. I mean, with temp music, we had a bit of music by Jacques Lussier in there for the very end piece. It was a beautiful...
The piece in the slow motion part where,
yeah,
Bruce is dying and Madeline's looking at him, and then all of a sudden she realizes that the boy must be there and that the boy is calling. She's looking around for him.
It's a beautiful violin concerto. It's so simple and so pure. And Robin Clark, the music editor, found this piece of music and we put it on, and it was brilliant. It was so touching and so simple and so pure. And this created a nightmare situation for Paul Buckmaster, the composer. And this is one of the worst things about temp music on films, is you taking bits of music that were written by the greatest composers of history that have been, you know, worked, they've had, you know, years, months to write the stuff and perform it. And we're asking a composer, to, in the course of a couple months, come up with equally good tunes and put them on the film. And
yeah,
that's a very difficult position to put people in.
But it has to be done, because of course the composer who you've taken from, he's not hitting the actual,
yeah,
beats of the music tied to picture that you want him to hit. He's only close.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to have it totally fulfilling.
But it's very strange, because you are asking, you're putting composers into very difficult situations. They've got to achieve what that does, plus make it work perfectly,
right,
with the picture. So it's a double job, and it has to be done overnight. So it's always very difficult, and it happens on every film. And one of the worst things as a, you know, director, you put the temp music on, and you really get used to it, and you like it, and you can't see it any other ways, and then comes the final score, and it always seems like a disappointment, because it isn't doing what it did. And sometimes it takes me a very long time to get used to what's finally on the film, and ultimately then you can see it and hear it and know it works.
In this particular case, I think first we did a rather lengthy debate about whether or not we were going to try to replace Lussier.
Mm.
Then finally, when we came to the decision, well, you know, we have the Lussier, which we did ultimately license, because what Paul came up with was more than inspired by Lucien.
Yeah.
He took definitely chords from him, or bars, I think is what the rule of thumb is. And so we went back and we said, okay, well, let's since we have Lucien, let's let Paul go in and try to do a recording session and see if he can do better. And he got really close, I remember, he got really close, but then we put the two movies up together, yeah. And it wasn't quite right, yeah. And he said, no, this isn't right. And so we debated again about whether or not we should try and let him go again. And we were running the deadline when we had to turn the film over to Universal to start, because I needed to start showing it for publicity purposes. And
we did it. We went again and got it.
Yeah, we got it the second time. Yeah. And it was really a good feeling. I think it was a good emotional time but for everybody as we were closing down the movie.
It was an interesting moment because the night before I came back from wherever I had been and Paul hadn't written a note because he'd been so blocked by the impossibility of improving upon that thing. And I remember sitting up till well after midnight. No, a little bit more there, a little bit less there, and sort of guiding him through, holding his hand and saying, no, go major there. And then leaving him to put it all together. But it was that frightening moment when somebody is so convinced that he cannot improve on the original, and yet